You'll turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 18. The story of this young man is recorded there. The young man is Jonathan. When we say young man, we're not certain of his age. Could have been upwards around 30. But that was still young relatively to the king, his father, Saul. And so, even at that age, the quandary in which he found himself made it very, very difficult for him. You see in 1 Samuel 18 and verse 1, the story setting. It came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as himself. Go over to chapter 20. Verse 17. Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies." And Jonathan made David vow again because of his love for him, because he loved him as he loved his own life. Look at verse 41 and 42. When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed each other and wept together, but David more. That's the Jonathan and David. Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" Now look at 2 Samuel chapter 1. This is after Jonathan had died. And David has this lament over Saul and Jonathan. And in chapter 1 verse 26, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was more wonderful than the love of women." The bond between these two young men was very, very strong. A bond of devotion and care. Brotherly affection between them. They appreciated one another for who they were. And they wanted to protect one another and honor one another. This friendship that they enjoyed was challenged. And it was challenged by Jonathan's father, Saul, who became David's enemy and was his enemy until he died. Saul became suspicious of David. His suspicions were unfounded. But because of his suspicions, he thought David would take the throne. He was too well liked by the people. And so he became his enemy and actually wanted to put him to death. So here's Jonathan. Here's his daddy. Obviously, he loves his daddy. He's also the king and deserves honor as the king. But here's his beloved friend, David. And we'll see as we go through the story, he's got to make choices. Difficult, difficult choices. Choices that would tear at a person's heart. But this is where Jonathan's at in this particular story. So let's begin with the first question on the sheet. Why did Saul, Jonathan's father, consider David his enemy? And was he justified in his views? Look at chapter 18, verse 6. So I've already mentioned why he was suspicious. Here is one of the events that led to Saul's unfounded suspicion. Sometimes people can do something that's very innocent, but people take it in the wrong way. You can't necessarily keep that from happening. You've got to realize whether or not these people have charged you or been suspicious of you on objective basis or a subjective basis. This is where it demands that we endeavor to have objective judgment about ourselves, or we will condemn ourselves when we shouldn't. David was not seeking the throne to take it away from Saul. In the story of David that follows to the end of Samuel, he had a number of opportunities to do that, and he did not. But here it begins. David, as a very young man, has conquered Goliath, the giant. And it says, verse 6, it happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. The women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Then Saul became very angry. Stop with me a moment. What fault of character caused Saul to be angry over this? Jealousy. Pride and jealousy. That's right. Of course, he had nothing to be jealous of, really, the praise of the people, but that doesn't mean David was trying to take his kingdom. But he was jealous of the praise that was heaped on David. And it says, this saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Note his reasoning or lack of it. This is what gets us into trouble. We hear somebody say something, we observe an event, we draw conclusions that are unfounded. Note the last sentence. Now, what more can he have but the kingdom? Result, verse 9. And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. And so you may see two people talking and you think, well, they're talking about me. Well, are they? Maybe they look at you and laugh. Well, maybe you think they're ridiculing me. Are they? Maybe not. It may be something very innocent. I mean, I don't even be talking about you at all. But this is what happened in this particular case, and it happens in human experience over and over again. The lesson about Saul, though that's not our focus, is a lesson for you and me. Not to draw unfounded conclusions about people and their motives and their intents. Look at chapter 20. You see again Saul's anger because of his suspicions about David and his kingdom. Not only Saul's rule, but his son, who would have been in the dynasty, getting the throne. Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. In other words, Jonathan was covering for David for him not being present at this particular gathering. And he said, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send him and bring him to me, for he must surely die. So beside Saul's own pride about himself, there was the concern about his dynasty, about his son sitting on the throne. And therefore he was jealous of David. You're Jonathan. What do you do? This is your daddy. He's the king. This is your friend. We don't have many young people here tonight, but you may be faced with those kind of choices. You've got good parents, so maybe you won't. But it doesn't have to be a parent. It can be somebody you love or respect, a grandma, a grandfather, a relative. What do you do? And Jonathan's at that decision point. Does he do what is right? Or does he please his daddy? And what about his own destiny? What about him being the king? If indeed Saul's suspicions are correct about David going to inherit the kingdom. And so this is the quandary that Jonathan finds himself in, and you will find yourself in as you grow older, young people. May not be between a father and somebody, maybe between two friends. You have to choose what's right. Maybe there's somebody you really don't like, and your friend and that person differ. What are you going to do? The right thing to do is the right choice. And so that's where Jonathan's at in our story. Now look at 1 Kings 19. Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all of his servants to put David to death. Saul tried several things to get David to be killed. He offered him wives, and Saul said, all I want is you to kill some Philistines. He thought so that to take care of David. Well, that didn't work. And so Saul just tells his servants to put David to death. But here we have that statement again about Jonathan's love for David. Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. And so we ask the question on the lesson. What did Jonathan tell him to do? And there's the answer. And so, Jonathan chose to do what is right and disobey the king and his father. Now, Jonathan's in this dilemma. Here's his dad. He wants to kill David. What does Jonathan do so far as David is concerned? What should he do? And so that's what we have as we continue in the story. Start in verse 2. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now, therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. And if I find out anything, then I shall tell you. Look back in chapter 18, verse 11. If Jonathan not only refused to do what his father said, but then went and informed his father's enemy about his father's plans, and his father got angry, what does chapter 18, verse 11 indicate about where that put Jonathan? His father could kill him. He's a man given to intense and quick anger. And when people get angry, oftentimes they lose their rationality. So he's the king, a lot of authority and power, and he's his daddy. But he loves Jonathan, and he goes and tries to go to David and give him the information that might preserve his life. And so when you reach decisions about between people, and if you make a decision, it could bring you trouble. Will you do it or just say, that's none of my business? That's my dad's business and David's business. I'm going to stay out of it. Or do you do what is right, even if it puts you on the firing line and you could get in trouble? That's what Jonathan, this young man, chose to do. And now we look at what he did with his father. This is a remarkable young man. Verse 4. Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father. But that's not all. Look, he said, "Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. For he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause?" So he went to his daddy. There's no indication he raised his voice, shouted, struck his dad. He reasoned with him. "Dad, this is not right. This is sin. And why would you treat this man that way when actually what he's done has been a benefit to you?" It's very rational discussion that Jonathan is having. This is the right way to act. Instead of our face getting red and waving our arms, getting mad, he reasoned with his dad about the wrongness of his thinking and conduct. Verse 6 says, "Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan and bowed." As you read the story of Saul, it wasn't only this time. It was several times that he said, "Okay, I agree, I won't kill David." When David could have killed him, and when he was in the cave, and David let him know, he repented that "I've sinned, I'm sorry, I won't do it," and he quit chasing. Happened again, same thing. Saul was not a man you could trust. There are people like that. They make a vow, but you can't trust them. Saul was that kind of man. He said, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." What do you call a statement like that? Swear. That's right. It's an oath. He swore. The people that are not truthful, they put their hand on the Bible and say, "I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but truth," and get up and lie. And so Saul, maybe he was sincere at the time he said it. I don't know. But anger and jealousy and pride is going to rule again in Saul's life. So Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these words. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as formerly. So it looks like things are kind of patched up. David's in his presence again. But you see, in verse 8, there was war again. David went out and fought with the Philistines and defeated them with great slaughter so that they fled before him. So, you know, David was a man of war. He killed people. He didn't murder people, but he killed people. There's a difference. He could have killed Saul any time he got ready. But he didn't. David was a young warrior. Saul was an older king. But he went to war, had this great victory. Verse 9, there was an evil spirit from the Lord on Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the harp with his hand. Saul tried to pin David to the wall with the spear. So here's a third time. Besides trying to employ his daughters in a conspiracy to have David killed by the Philistines, using his own children, and then trying to get his sons to do it, he himself personally tried to commit murder with David at least these three times. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 20. Sometimes good friends have different opinions about a matter. They don't see things alike. And in spite of all that's happened, Jonathan vision is not real clear, it seems. It's his daddy. You love your daddy. And children love their daddy, regardless sometimes how sorry they are. That doesn't mean they're trustworthy and that they ought to be defended. But look here in chapter 20, verse 1 through 3. David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father that he's seeking my life?" And he said to him, Jonathan said to David, "Far from it. You shall not die." I don't know how much time passed between what you read in 19 and 20. But Jonathan says, "Nah, there's nothing going on, David. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me?" Now note that last statement in the verse. It is not so. In other words, David, you're my dear friend, but you're wrong about this, buddy. How do you reckon it made Jonathan feel for his best friend to accuse his father of being a murderer or the intent to murder when Jonathan did not agree? How would that make you feel? So here's two dear friends. You're going to differ with your dear friends sometimes. And that's what happened on this particular occasion. And so, verse 3, David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.'" In other words, your dad's hiding it from you, Jonathan. He knows we're best friends. And so that's why he's not telling you about his plans. "But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there's hardly a step between me and death." So they differ. And Jonathan concedes in the sense that he says, "Okay, whatever you say, I'll do for you. If that's what you think, you tell me what you want me to do." And so they devise this plan to see where Saul is at in his thinking. And you see that at the new moon, the king had some kind of a feast or gathering. David was expected to be there. David purposely was not there. Now, whether he lied about his purpose or whether he actually went to Bethlehem to a family gathering, I don't know. But be that as it may, David determined not to be at that gathering and asked Jonathan to report back to him about what his father's attitude was. And so they had the gathering. David wasn't there. Saul didn't know why he wasn't there, but he was concerned about it. And so Jonathan told this story in verse 28-29. Again, I don't know if it's a lie or not. It's a story they concocted. And then Saul revealed himself in verse 30. Saul's anger burned against Jonathan. He said to him, and we read this a while ago, "Don't you realize, boy, this guy's going to get your inheritance, the throne?" And the way our Bible's translated, it kind of softens it. But I guess this is the kind of language you hear people use today that's profane, cursing, filthy. The way people say it today. Saul's an angry, unreasonable man. And his pride and jealousy is driving him instead of rational thought. You know, when you talk about pride and jealousy, while we're not studying Saul, it's such a good lesson about it. Because what you see is where sin takes people. Sin doesn't start and stop. If you don't stop it, it just keeps going. When Saul was chosen king, was he prideful? Not at all. Not at all. In fact, he kind of hid, you know, among the baggage. But then things began to happen. He offered a sacrifice he had no authority to ask. Lack of faith. And then, of course, you have the story of the Amalekites. And Samuel told him he was going to lose his dynasty. And one thing led to another. And now the man is at the point that he's willing to merchandise his own family. He's willing to get his own son to commit murder. He's willing to cuss out his son. And that's what sin will do. It progresses more and more and more. And so it's not the kind of thing, it's just one time and just, okay. It can easily, completely overwhelm a person and their character. So, you can imagine the strain that's put on their friendship between Jonathan and David, this differing of opinion. Jonathan saw his daddy's attitude was still murderous. And so in accord with the plan, David's hidden in the field and shot the arrows beyond David, which meant you need to go away. If I shoot the arrows on this side, tell you to come, everything's okay. And so then you have that tender statement that we read a while ago at the end of the chapter about them meeting, kissing one another. Must have been a heartbreaking moment for both of them. They loved one another. They wanted to be together, but they knew they couldn't. Why? Jonathan's daddy. Isn't that sad? Not somebody out in the community. Not a Philistine. One of them's a member of one of them's family. It doesn't have to be a daddy. It can be a mama who's jealous. It can be a family relative. They can drive a wedge between good people. You've got to make the choice to do the right thing, even though it may be your dear grandma, grandpa, uncle, aunt, whatever it may be. But that's the situation you have here. Your heart may be torn into pieces as these two young men were.
Is almost, yes, they're having to be torn apart, but it's also the, in my processing, the realization that Jonathan is having to come to about his father, where he had so strongly defended him. And he's realizing, my father's really not a good guy. And that's heartbreaking for Jonathan. And then you have David, who probably is heartbroken as well because he's making his best friend realize how not a good guy his father is. And it's just all-encompassing in that.
That's tough, isn't it?
It's horrible.
To come to realization and have to admit my daddy is not a good guy. Right.
And so people will do that. They will, instead of looking at themselves, accepting, you know, that they're at fault and that they need to turn around and do differently, they attack the people that are trying to get them to be better.
Young people in this audience, you know what you need to pray about tonight, reading this story? Better thank God for your daddy and mama. There's people in this audience, older people, who face the difficulty of having relatives, whether a father or mother, that they had to stand against. If you've got a father and mother that's living right, trying to do right, train you to do right, you better thank God for that kind of father and mother. It's wonderful memory. When you get older, go back in your history and to be able to say, I can never, ever remember my father or my mother expecting me to do something that is wrong. So, will you become a father or mother? This is one of the richest inheritances you can give them, that memory. As you will never pressure them to do what they believe is wrong. But that's the dilemma that Jonathan is facing. We've read chapter 20, 30, and 31. Go back and look at it just a moment. This is an allusion to what Jonathan stood to lose out of all of this. So why does Jonathan care? Because you see in these two verses, the kingdom is at stake, the rule, the dominion. Who's going to be the next king? And you know that in Israel, usually the son was the next king. They didn't vote for the ruler like we do in the United States of America. It was not a democracy. And so at stake was Jonathan's right to the throne. And so he had a personal interest. Well, look at chapter 23. This tells you something else about this young man. If you're king, you're the top dog. You have power. You have money. You can have women. You can live in a castle. But here, somebody else besides Jonathan looks like he's going to get the kingdom. And it's his best friend. How does Jonathan feel about it? Verse 16, Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God, in connection with God, in God's plans. Evidently, Jonathan recognized this was God's plan. Thus he said to him, do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you, and you will be king over Israel. And I will be next to you. I won't be the top guy, but I'll be there to serve you. And Saul, my father, knows that also. So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. Jonathan was an humble man. Young man, but an humble man. I'm not going to be the king, David, you are, but I'll tell you, I'll be right there at your right hand to serve you. What a great attitude. I don't have to have the limelight. I don't have to be number one. But I'll fulfill my role with honor. And so a remarkable young man, this Jonathan. In chapter 20, verse 30 and 34, 30 through 34, it's just a question to think about, but there's a comment here that I have on your lesson. After his father's violent reaction in word, you see how he talked to Jonathan, verse 30, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. And indeed, verse 33, remember we read earlier about what Saul did to David and how that might impact Jonathan? Here it is. That's exactly what happened. Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. Going to kill his own son. I cannot imagine. I asked the question, but I don't know. I mean, I can read what it says. It says, Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger. And then, of course, he went to tell David about his dad's attitude. Imagine the conflicting emotions. He's angry. I mean, really angry with his daddy. But he's grieved about David and what his daddy was gonna or wanted to do toward David. Note that verse 34. He was grieved over David. But as to Jonathan, he was full of fierce anger. There's conflicting emotions. You ever feel like conflicting emotions? Ever run across circumstances like that? Nothing new. Now what do you got to do? You do what is right. That's what you do. Right at the end of the lesson, we've got some verses that have to do with a great example. Of course, our Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. If you watch movies or television shows, read books, you know that there's a philosophy, an idea that family is everything. Blood comes before anything or anyone. Family's number one. A lot of people feel that way. I'll lie for my family. I'll kill for my family. I don't mean defend them, but do things that are wrong. My family. The word family comes to, is such a powerful word. It comes to describe gangs or sports teams, things like that. And then you get into family attitude. They're my brother. I'll do anything for my brother. Look at Jesus' attitude. Luke chapter 2. Jesus taught us to love our family, to love our mother and father, to honor our mother and father, provide for our mother and father, taught parents to train their children, provide for their children, show compassion to their children. But family is not number one with Jesus Christ. In Luke chapter 2, you have this story. We're not going to read it all. You'll see verse 41, his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. They left thinking Jonathan was with them. Verse 44, they'd already went a day's journey. That's not a day's journey in a fine air-conditioning automobile. That's walking. And they saw Jesus wasn't with them. So they returned to Jerusalem, verse 45. You're the parent. What's your attitude about this time? You left. Where's that boy? How old is he? 12. Boy, when I find that kid, got to take another day to get back to Jerusalem. Where they find him? Verse 46, in the temple. Listening and asking questions. It'd be interesting to have the tone of his parents in verse 48. How this sounded when you would have heard it. Son, why have you treated us this way? I don't know if that's the way they said it or if it was filled with tears and heartbreak or anger. Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you. So that's the mother speaking. He said to them, why is it that you were looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be? Now this version translates, in my father's house. The King James Version translates, about my father's business. I got a higher father. And I got allegiance to him that supersedes my allegiance to you. And he wanted his parents to learn that lesson. Did he love them? Yes. They needed to learn that lesson. And he was unashamed to speak this way. That there's a higher allegiance than mom and dad. Look at John chapter 2. Here he used, I must be about my father's business. Here's this wedding in Cana, chapter 2. And Jesus was there. It says, verse 3, the wine ran out. So the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Jesus said to her, woman, what do I have to do with you? My hour has not yet come. Did Mary want him to show his powers, his glory? You know, she had had some indescribable events in her young years. The announcement of the birth of a son when she was a virgin. And of course, we don't have any data about his childhood, but you can kind of fill in the blanks in view of who he was. And now, they're out of wine, son. My hour has not yet come. The hour for him to be glorified. His mother didn't understand his mission. Didn't understand he came to die. And so here we have in this particular setting, he would not let her well-intentioned wishes. I don't doubt that she had good intentions. But he would not let her well-intentioned wishes deter him from the schedule of his mission. He had a mission, had a schedule. How old was he? His mission's just begun. How old was he?
30.
About 30. Young man. Much as he loved his mother and daddy, his mission to serve God was foremost. And then in Matthew chapter 12, look at Matthew chapter 12. Verse 46. While he was still speaking to the multitudes, behold, his mother and brothers were standing outside seeking to speak to him. Someone said to him, behold, your mother and your brothers are standing outside seeking to speak to you. But he answered the one who was telling him and said, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And stretching out his hand toward the disciples, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my brother and sister and mother. Do we feel that way? That as much as we love our family, that we love people that are serving our Master even more. You can form bonds of faith with Christians that supersede the bonds of flesh. I enjoy some of those very bonds with certain people that I believe are serving God. And Jesus said, that's the ones that he treasures. Not that he didn't care about his mother and brothers, but because they were blood relatives did not make them number one in his concerns and appreciation. Same thing in Matthew 10 when he instructed his disciples to go out and preach the gospel, which would divide families. You know, what do you think of somebody that will divide a family? Jesus said, I did not come to bring peace but a sword. I came to set a man against his father, the daughter against her mother, the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Am I understanding this? Does that mean if I love my family more than I love the Lord, and I'm not willing to do what he says because of discord in the family, that I can't be a Christian? That sounds like it to me. You make your own judgment. Our time is up. In fact, we're a little over. Thank you for your good attention tonight.